The 1997 Sunstone Symposium presents The Waning of Mormon Ethnicity, Thoughts on Mormon and American Cultures by Steve Epperson, with comments by Daryl White.
This day. For your edification, this is session 311 on The Waning of Mormon Ethnicity, Thoughts on Mormon and American Cultures. So if you're in the wrong room, you may want to check your schedule and be advised. I've been asked to remind everyone that admission to these sessions are by ticket or by name tag. So if you have snuck in here through the service entrances, feel free to feel guilty and please see somebody at the registration desk and pay up, please. Well, years ago, it was that the topic or question of hot debate was, are Mormons Christian? Now it seems that that people argue over, are Mormons ethnic? And that is the focus of today's session. We will first hear a paper read by Brother Steve Epperson, formerly a assistant professor of history at Brigham Young University and history curator at the Museum of History and Art. And I don't know if you're doing anything recent.
I enjoy vacation.
No, enjoying early retirement, maybe.
My wife and children see a lot of me.
Okay, good. Following Brother Epperson's paper, we will have some commentary by Brother Daryl White, who is chair of the Department of Sociology and Anthropology at Spelman College in Atlanta, Georgia. And then we will open it up for time for questions and answers after that. So, Brother Epperson.
I'd like really to thank you all for coming out here. It seems very early in the morning, and I think we could have been in a cozier and more intimate space. But if you excuse the elevated status here, about a year ago, a professor of history and ethnic studies at the California State University in San Bernardino, a fellow named Elliot Barkin, got a hold of me and asked me if I'd be willing to think about and write an essay for a collection of essays that would be reflecting on American ethnic groups. And I paused because I couldn't quite figure out what he was going to ask me to do. And then he said, well, I want to know if you'd be willing to write about the Mormon community as an American ethnic group. Well, then I paused again, because I've been trained in religious studies, and I've always tended to look at Mormons and at Mormonism in exclusively religious terms, not ethnic terms. I'm not an ethnographer. I'm not an anthropologist. I said, "Are you sure you have the right person?" And we talked for a while, and then he assured me, that yeah, I think that we'd want you to go ahead with this project. And I said, well, I may come up with conclusions that would argue quite differently, maybe from what you intend this to go. And he said, well, if that's the case, we'll all be edified, but, let's try it anyway. And so over a period of a couple of months, I plunged into the literature, both, the social scientific literature about what's an ethnic group, because I didn't even know what an ethnic group was, and I found out that it's a very, very loose definition, and you can define ethnic groups in all sorts of ways. And then I also started reading the literature by Mormon social scientists and others who are looking at Mormonism, some arguing that the Mormon community in America is indeed a religious/ethnic community, and others who argued that maybe that definition was a faulty one, and gave reasons for offering an alternative. And what I tried to do in an essay, a version of which I want to present to you, is I tried to put all of this together, try to synthesize this scholarship, draw upon my own experience as history curator at the Church Museum of History and Art here in Salt Lake, where I worked for 6 years and was involved in curating the permanent history exhibit that's on the main floor of the museum, and I was also the curator in charge of the Salt Lake Temple Centennial exhibit, and as well as teaching topics in American religious history at Brigham Young University for the past 4 years, and had came up basically with the thesis that I'd like to present to you today. And I hope at the end of it you'll offer your own observations, perhaps your own experiences that would help enlighten me, and especially if I'm wrong in your eyes. The title of this essay is The Creation and the Waning of Ethnicity. And it starts out like this. To denominate the members of a church with an international missionary force of 50,000 operating in 146 nations and territories, with a majority of its population residing outside the United States, and with more than 400 different ethnic and foreign language congregations within the United States alone, as comprising an American ethnic group may seem more than a little strange. To a large majority of its members, this category would appear foreign to their own self-description. And that's like my own comment there. It seemed foreign to me. Defining the Mormon community is a well-known conundrum to historians and social scientists. Their various definitions will vex anyone who would sum up this tradition and its adherents primarily in ethnic terms. Sidney Ahlstrom is a great historian of American religion. Tried his own definition that went something like this. One cannot even be sure if the object of our consideration is a sect, a mystery cult, a new religion, a church, a people, a nation, or an American subculture. Indeed, at different times and places, it is all of these. Recently, descriptions that stress the ethnicity of the Mormon community and that identify Mormons as an authentic American ethnic group have become more common. The inclusion of an essay on Mormons in the 1980 Harvard Encyclopedia of American Ethnic Groups written by Dean May of the University of Utah is a noteworthy example of this trend. Both before and since May's essay, a number of distinguished historians, geographers, and other social scientists have written important studies of Mormonism in which ethnicity served as an illuminating category. The overarching argument of this essay is that while once accurate, descriptions of the Mormon community as an American ethnic group will become increasingly ill-fitting. For more than a century after the founding of their religious community, Mormons came to possess many of the attributes of ethnicity, as I came to learn about ethnic groups. They defined themselves as a covenant people, and they were perceived by others as a separate and even sinister population. Mormons shared a territorial homeland, myths of origins and migrations, and particular cultural traits, including identities that were reinforced by kinship, discourse, theological claims, and liturgical practices. From the 1820s until well into the first decades of this century, they lived virtually unto themselves. So according to Thomas O'Day, about whom there are members of this audience, I think, are going to be, of whom there are members of this audience are going to be speaking today. Was it today or yesterday? We talked about O'Day. Okay. According to Thomas O'Day, who was a Catholic sociologist, American Catholic sociologist, who wrote this classic study of Mormonism in 1954, according to Thomas O'Day, Mormons, quote, came closer to evolving a genuine, locally and independently conceived ethnicity on this continent than did any other comparable group. However, the very traits once deemed essential for defining the distinctiveness of the Mormon community are undergoing fundamental change. A gathered people are dispersing throughout the country. A pariah community has now recently been dubbed, quote, the quintessential embodiment of mainstream American culture, end quote. Dramatic growth by proselytization outside the United States swells a once homogeneous community of largely British and Scandinavian descent with multi-ethnic converts. Also, changes in theology are making the public discourse of the faith more congruent with evangelical Christian scruples. In sum, a pre-Civil War millenarian religious sect that became an emerging nation, now strives to attain respectability as a worldwide church. Now, I want to talk about different aspects of what figured into the creation of an ethnic group, an emerging ethnic group, and then do a little bit of analysis. I want to talk first about migration and settlement and the process of adjustment, and then economic and political issues. And we'll go right along there. Tens of thousands, so this is going to be a quick historical survey here. Tens of thousands of individuals forged an emerging Mormon ethnic identity in the 19th century by conversion to the beliefs and extraordinary pretensions of their restored gospel and by their subsequent experience of migration and community building on the American frontier. Neither condition alone, belief, migration, neither condition alone was sufficient for the genesis and maintenance of a Mormon ethnicity. Together, however, they led to the development of such a strong Mormon identity, as Jan Shipps has noted, that saints gave up existing birthrights and past identities to create new ideals, institutions, and group sentiments, which they then passed on intact from one generation to another in the face of extraordinary opposition. The theological claims of Joseph Smith and the church building and his church building may have been ridiculed along with the credulity of his followers, but in the sectarian hurly-burly of pre-Civil War American culture, the new religious movement would have been grudgingly tolerated, save for one key doctrine, and that's what the Mormons call the gathering. Mormons in the 19th century believed in the imminent second coming of Christ, along with many other Christians, and the establishment of a millennial kingdom of righteousness on earth, not just in churches, but through the joint efforts of divine powers and the labors of the saints. Joseph Smith revealed that the true believers in Christ and his gospel must prepare for these events by gathering out from Babylon and settling not just in pews, but into religious communities of anticipation within a prophetically designated sanctified territory. And it was this exclusionist geopolitical practice of gathering out and building, taking over territory, if you will, in the 19th century, which proved intolerable to Mormon the neighbors of 19th century Mormons, not only to the neighbors, but also to local and federal governments. For in their attempts to create a distinctive territorial enclave, Mormons encountered what geographer D.W. Meinig has described, quote, as the relentless pressures of American imperialism, which denied absolutely the creation or formal recognition of any kind of ethnic territorial units within the United States. But that was precisely the aim of the Mormon gathering, the creation of economically and socially self-sufficient and self-governing religious communities. To create their Zion on the American frontier, Mormon converts hurled themselves into a nearly perpetual state of migration, settlement, and conflict from 1830 to 1900. And I give a brief sketch of it, but, well, you all know that quite well, that story. But I want to focus in on this geopolitical aspect, because I found it fascinating, something that all of a sudden made Missouri make sense. In contrast to this orderly vision for group life and what Mormons were trying to accomplish, they encountered disorder and conflict in their relations with neighboring populations through the mid-1840s. Gentile citizens objected strenuously to Mormon attempts to control both territory and the character of the society under their jurisdiction. They viewed Mormon sectarian separation as clannish and unrepublican, and Mormon fraternization with Native American tribes as you know, consorting with the nation's implacable foes. I mean, it was seen as, you know, bordering on treason. In sum, Mormon ideology and practices appeared so alien, so inimical to the conventions of their contemporaries, that state and local officials resorted to the strategy already employed with terrible success against Native peoples east of the Mississippi: forced expulsion. Lilburn Boggs was not a solitary, isolated kook, all right, who had a thing against Mormons. He put into practice a policy that was standard operating practice in the United States in the 1830s. Andrew Jackson had effectively, you know, checked the Supreme Court's decision to try to stop forced expulsions of Cherokees from Georgia by the state government. Supreme Court said the actions of the state of Georgia were unconstitutional. Andrew Jackson's reply was, well, you know, let, you know, where are John Marshall's troops? It's sort of like Stalin saying, where are the Pope's divisions, you know? I mean, Mr. Marshall, the Supreme Court justice, the chief of the Supreme Court, had made a decision, let him try to enforce it now, you see. And then Jackson put into practice a policy of removing all Native American tribes who were trying to not only create a people, but also to control territory. America was aggressively expansionistic, and anybody who was trying to control territory and create self-sufficient economic and political units, you know, were deemed unacceptable. So the Lilburn Boggs extermination order, again, was not an exceptional act in the 1830s. Rather, it fit right in to American political practice. That all of a sudden, you know, it was a revelation to me. It's very interesting. Maybe you all know it already. But the entire Mormon population of Missouri was uprooted by state decree, and by 1846, more than 20,000 Mormons were forced from homes and farms and sent off on an epic migration to remote mountain valleys of the Great Basin, that was then in the Mexican territory. They're hoping they're going to get away from American territory, you know, imperial expansion. No such luck. The effects of persecution and forced migration had an enormous impact on the development of a distinctive Mormon identity. They fostered a sectarian, binary worldview wherein the saints formed cohesive group solidarities ranged against a demonized outside world. They alienated Mormons from predominant American cultures and institutions for decades. The violence and movement of the 1830s and 40s helped Mormons to create a powerful mythic history. As a biblically centered millenarian sect, they read the experiences of settlement, expulsion, and relocation through the narrative template of Scripture: a garden lost, a people in exile, a promised homeland, epic migration, kingdom building, and the hope of redemption. All compelled 19th century Mormons to identify closely with what they understood about biblical Israel. The imaginative analogies that Mormons drew embraced not only narrative constructs, but the liturgical and social institutions of temple worship, prophetic and priestly offices, and a rhetorical construction of blood descent. By calling themselves the descendants of Ephraim, an indigenous American people's Manasseh, Mormons linked the heritage and the future of the exiled and marginalized in this country together, and they connected them with those of the covenant Jewish people and claimed a central redemptive role for all three tribes in the imminent messianic millennial age, where the first would be last and the last first. Mormons, Indians, and Jews would be first. Besetment from without and identity construction from within form strong communal ties of rhetoric and kinship, and the combination of all this analogical activity with colonization efforts carried out in the relative isolation on the western slope of the American Rockies between 1846 and 1900 enabled Mormons to build a commonwealth and a near ethnicity, aspects of which persist into the present. For over a span of 40 years, an extraordinary variety of people hailing from America's many regions, and also from British metropolitan and imperial domains, Scandinavia, continental Europe, and the Ottoman Middle East, congregated to the Great Basin to create Zion yet again. What they produced, again in Meinig's, the geographer, D.W. Meinig's words, what they produced was a homeland with a homogeneity, unity, order, and self-consciousness unequaled in any other American region. End quote. Before the centrally orchestrated colonization of this region came to an end, more than 150,000 Mormon settlers established nearly 700 towns, villages, and way stations, which stretched from southern Alberta to northern Mexico and from western Colorado to San Bernardino, California. More than 80,000 Mormon converts immigrated from Europe to participate in settlement efforts, the vast majority coming from Great Britain and Scandinavian countries. Most British converts were urban artisans, mechanics, and industrial laborers who subsequently tended to settle in the growing city centers of northern Utah. By contrast, Scandinavian proselytes were drawn largely from rural and agrarian backgrounds and they pioneered and farmed the landscapes of central and far northern Utah and southern Idaho. By 1886, more than a third of the population of Utah was foreign-born. Whether indigent or better off financially, all of these converts were drawn by the gathering, along with American citizens who became Mormons. And as a result of profound conversion experiences and the undeniable appeal of Mormon missionary themes of fraternity and economic franchisement, missionaries taught Danish farmers and Manchester textile workers not only the restoration of the gospel and the gifts of the Spirit, they also promised the faithful that Zion would provide a sanctuary from economic privation and class ostracism, that the saints would arrive to find sufficient land to cultivate, gainful employment, guaranteed association with fellow believers, and the promise of upward mobility. It was a very heady and a very attractive mix. Studies of immigration indicate that the remaking of Swedes, here we're talking about the making of an ethnicity, the studies of immigration indicate the remaking of Swedes and Scots into Mormons began during the long journeys to Zion and continued through their arrival and placement in Mormon settlements. 19th century Mormon diaries, like those of Danish converts Anthon Lund and Ferdinand Hintze, chronicle the typical process of assimilation through which foreign converts passed from traditional languages, customs, and affiliations into a new Mormon identity. These multi-volume diaries, written in Danish in the 1850s and 60s, shift incrementally but decisively into English in the 1870s, and they end up reflecting not Danish landscapes, but church-wide concerns, business, recreation, and associations, not just those of Scandinavian enclaves in San Pete and Cache counties, but a burgeoning regional community. Indeed, Anthon Lund, rose to the highest administrative positions in the Mormon Church and served on the directorships of numerous financial and business institutions. Between 1850 and 1890, Mormons came closest to inventing a distinctive ethnicity for themselves. During this period, they grew from a sect of 52,000 to an important regional population of over 250,000. Mythic kinships, particular religious beliefs, geographical isolation, political autonomy, economic autarky, and uniform town planning, outside perceptions of their distinctiveness, the list goes on, were the principal factors contributing to the near success of transforming a sectarian religious group into a separate people. Now, Dean May concluded from this in his essay on Mormons that church members representing extra-Mormon ethnicities assimilated rapidly upon entering Zion because, unlike non-Mormon immigrant settlers, they moved into tightly structured, hierarchical, closely knit villages where pressures to conform were very great. The result, he concluded, was considerable uniformity in cultural expression. It is not clear, however, and this is where we start maybe moving away from this picture of Mormons creating a very unique and particular identity. It's not clear, however, that Mormon material culture of the 19th century confirms that this was an era of such uniformity and homogeneity that one can say that even here Mormons had become a separate and distinct American ethnic group. It is true that American graphic artists, like the famous Thomas Nast, drew Mormons with beards, goat horns, and harems, and placed them along with Uncle Sam's other troublesome ethnicities, like Irish, Chinese, and Jews, very distinctively in a category of their own. The graphic images of the late 19th century of Mormons are really, really amazing. It's a great book by Davis Bitten and Gary Bunker about the Mormon graphic image. I really recommend you take a look through. If nothing else, good laugh. It's also true that Mormons in this period shared distinctive beliefs, institutions, stories, and experiences. But numerous institutions, folkways, and cultural traits persisted in the Mormon community which served to maintain various native ethnic identities. For example, Mormon ethnic historian Jesse Embry has noted that church members supported dozens of ethnic congregations and foreign language newspapers from 1880 to 1915, and yet again in the 1920s and 30s. These media may have served the purpose not only of integrating foreign members into a composite American Mormon ethnicity, they also served, I believe, to foster lingering ethnic ties to native countries, cultures, and languages. Two permanent exhibits installed in the late 1980s at the Church Museum where I worked tell through material cultural artifacts a similar story of persistent and diverse ethnicities within the Mormon community. In its Masterworks Gallery, which is an art gallery on the second floor, its Masterworks Gallery displays impressive examples of recognizable British, Scandinavian, and American regional artistic genres. There is no unique Mormon school or style which arose out of an amalgam of all these disparate elements. In the history exhibit downstairs, on which I curated, museum curators drew upon an extensive collection of artifacts from a host of ethnic cultures that were cherished and preserved lovingly by descendants of pioneering ancestors. All of these intimate reminders of enduring and lively connections to homes, families, landscapes, and trades beyond the Rocky Mountains that Mormon pioneers and their children were loath to relinquish. Mormons may have created a landscape imprinted sporadically with towns, public and domestic buildings, farms, and water systems of their own design, which resulted in what geographers call a distinctive Mormon country. Closer scrutiny, however, reveals that even in the 19th century, Mormons brought with them a widely eclectic range of architectural styles, construction techniques, and handcrafts. What were considered typical Mormon landscapes and material culture in the Intermountain West have, in the 20th century, been rapidly subsumed into national, not ethnic, styles of building and settling. By the end of this century, those of you who want to go up and down the Wasatch Front, there is little that differentiates the way Mormons settle, communicate, vacation, commute, work, and consume from non-Mormons, no matter in what region of the United States Mormons happen to live. They've abandoned village and agrarian life for suburban tract housing, urban apartments, and congested roads. Vast orchards of fruit planted by pioneers as part of a drive to create a diverse, self-sustaining, agrarian-based culture, as you all know, most of them have been hewn down to make way for strip malls, gated communities, and automobile dealerships. Mormon folk music and dance, even those that were derivative from British Isles and Scandinavian styles, and maybe people might have thought this was very Mormon, have been largely displaced by commercially formatted and mass-produced pop music. A really big one of the big experiences in my life was going down to Spring City for Turkey Days, and there was a walk through the historical city, and beautiful place. And at the end, there was supposed to be a party and a dance and an outdoor turkey roast on the public in the park. And I had visions of a little Mormon string band and lots of square dancing and all of that. And we went down there, and on the gazebo, instead of a band, was a big Sony boombox. and canned pre-programmed music that was played, and then there was this lovely young woman who sat with a microphone and sang this really syrupy, swoopy kind of Christian music. It was amazing, and so if someone wants to go to someplace that's really distinctively ethnically Utah Mormon, even there, what may have been ethnic once upon a time, at least in my eyes, certainly has been uprooted. And then when you go to other places, we used to go down to Orem, American Fork, on drives on old Highway 89 with my parents, and felt like I was in Mormon country. You drive down 89 now through Orem, and you could be in Plano, Texas, or you could be in Bellingham. You don't know where you are anymore. So I have this very strong sense that for 50 years Mormons tried very hard to build an ethnic identity, but they've been spending the next 50 years hewing down as quickly and as gustily, with as much gusto as possible, hewing that down. Even if Mormons had consciously set out to create a distinctive ethnic identity, 15 years of conflict, settlement, and migration in the American Midwest, and then 40 years of relative isolation in the Great Basin, were periods of insufficient duration in which to create a separate and enduring material, aesthetic, and religious culture. It wasn't enough time. And I also don't think there was enough unanimity in mind. In the mid-1800s, a Mormon theorist like Louis Bertrand, who was a former French socialist and who converted to Mormonism, predicted that the Mormon community would become a new people, gathered from all the nations and faiths, who would then, in his words, coordinate all good and true principles from their former cultures into an unprecedented general symbol that would be distinctively Mormon. What happened instead was that in the 1910s, other immigrant saints, like the Norwegian-born John A. Widso, advised converts, quote, to assimilate into the American life stream and acquire an American identity, end quote. I would submit that they complied readily. Between Bertrand's predictions in 1862 and Widso's post-World War I council, Mormons had undergone what Thomas Alexander has described as a paradigm shift. Due to the impact of intrusive and punitive federal legislation, the death of a more militant first generation, insufficient arable land to support a rapidly growing community, and a growing desire to normalize relations with the dominant American cultures, Mormons abandoned many of their most distinctive institutions and practices. Polygamous marriages, church-owned cooperative businesses, a religious political party, and the doctrine of the gathering to Zion, all of these and more were discontinued by the Mormon community beginning in the 1890s. The end of the gathering led directly to the reconfiguration of Mormon population patterns and accelerated the erosion of ethnicity. Second and third generation Mormons began to move to urban areas in Utah and along the West Coast in search of employment. In the 1890s, Utah's overwhelmingly Mormon population was about 65% rural, 35% urban. And 20 years later, the mix was even. Urban growth in Utah between 1900 and 1910 approached 60%, while in the United States overall it was only 35%. Today Utah is one of the top six or seven most urbanized states in the Union, and I think that drift towards urbanization proceeds apace. Meanwhile, church leaders, in a marked departure from the sectarian rhetoric of the 19th century, began to advocate a policy of assimilation. And by assimilation, I point to the following declaration as an example. In 1907, church leaders declared, and it was sustained in every ward and stake in the church, declared that the church, it was declared by the church hierarchy and ratified by lay members, that stepped away from the millenarian and separatist rhetoric of the previous century by urging all church members, quote, to join hands with the civilization of this age, end quote, to promote the well-being of the human family through evangelization, education, the sanctification of marriage and family life, and the advocacy of religious liberty. The implications of these theological and demographic developments became apparent in the middle decades of the 20th century. And if anyone wants to read about those, I'd urge you to pick up Armin Moss's book on the Beehive and the Angel that chronicles this. And Armin, I want to acknowledge that I'm very dependent on a lot of your scholarship and very influenced by it in putting this essay together. Okay? It's a fine book, okay, in spite of some of the criticism I gave you in New Mexico a little while ago. Good books engender good criticism. What does that mean about some of the criticism I got for Mormons and Jews? Some of it wasn't so good, huh? Between 1920 and 1965, migration out of the core area of Mormon settlement continued, with significant numbers of Mormons becoming established in major American metropolitan areas in the West Coast, the Midwest, and Northeast. Now, I've got to move on. Just a couple things I want to underline about this migration into cities and migration out of the core regional area here in Utah. Service in the military, employment in industries and bureaucracies supporting the American World War and Cold War efforts, accelerated Mormon geographical diffusion, intermarriage, and professional specialization. Altogether, these forces eroded territorial and familial-based ethnicity. they also introduced compelling alternative allegiances to American Mormons for the first time since the creation of their religious communities. Mormons coming of age in this period, roughly from the post-World War I period up through the 50s, Mormons coming of age in this period migrated physically and ideologically from the relatively simple society of parents and grandparents into a diffuse and complex world. Here, identities, and think about your own experience now, okay? Here, identities were increasingly based upon present-oriented, functional roles of citizenship and workplace specialization, and not on regional, religious, and familial narratives steeped in Mormon myth. As never before, Mormons had to imperfectly balance loyalties and forge identities between the nation-state, workplace colleagues, the institutions of non-Mormon civil society, and their own religious tradition. They ended up exceeding the goal of reducing intercommunal tensions enjoined upon them by church leaders earlier in the century. And by the 1950s and 60s, Mormons came to view many social, economic, and political issues through much the same lens held by their Middle American contemporaries. Now, I want to move on. Something in this essay, I did talk quite a bit about how I felt the experience, the pilgrimage of Mormon women really is a very good example of the creation and the waning of ethnic identities. And while I was doing this, there's something else I wanted, and many of you know the story, others like Marie Cornwall, Maureen Beecher, and others have said it much better than I could. But there's something else that I found out about the 19th century and women's roles that to me was illuminating. And this had to do, again, with the religious ideology of gathering in the 19th century. This religious ideology had enabled tens of thousands of Mormons, so we're going back to the 19th century for a moment. The gathering had enabled tens of thousands of Mormon men and women to recreate many of the conditions of pre-industrial revolution societies from which American and European farmers and artisans had been alienated. The prospect of restoring dignity to working men and women by taking them out from the industrial and urban centers of Europe and America and returning them to village life and to artisan labor and pioneering yeoman art agriculture was profoundly attractive to many men and women searching for viable solutions to the woes of displaced laboring and agrarian workers. Heading into the last decades of the 19th century, Mormon women had created an astonishing range of identities for themselves in order to fulfill the needs of pioneering in the West. The distinctive roles they played in shaping Mormon culture in this era contributed to perceptions of Mormons as a people apart. And all these conditions, about which I've just spoken, began to change with astonishing speed beginning in the late 1880s. Now, some remarks briefly about economic and political integration and how those corroded this ethnic identity. Mormon experiences with migration and settlement entailed a profound engagement with American economic and political realities. From sectarian beginnings to nation building and cultural convergence, Mormons traveled from being numbered among the poorest and least powerful members of America's religious communities to enjoy currently an average socioeconomic status that now compares favorably with that of Episcopalians and Presbyterians. The 20th century Mormon quest for rapprochement with dominant American institutions has paid off handsomely in terms of augmented public power. In the 19th century, Mormons focused their economic and political efforts on creating autonomous geopolitical enclaves, about which we've spoken already. In colonizing the Great Basin, church members overcame harsh climatic conditions and scarce capital by supporting massive public work programs and local cooperative industries. Decades of privation served to foster a disciplined attitude towards personal consumption, time management, and a willingness to cooperate in efforts organized Economic and political behaviors such as self-sufficiency, cooperation, and collective management became hallmarks of 19th century Mormon community. And American political, cultural, and business elites objected to all three and pursued policies throughout the century and beyond aimed at dismantling Mormon enclaves and assimilating their populations. Their efforts succeeded beyond expectations. First of all, there was no site remote enough in the contiguous United States to which Mormons could migrate in order to fully realize their geopolitical aspirations. The irony of Mormon geography, as the geographer Meinig has said, is that fugitive Mormon settlement efforts always ran athwart American imperial expansion. In addition, most Americans perceived Mormons as so alien, militant, and inassimilable that they supported drastic civilizing measures carried out by the federal government. Between 1862 and 1887, in a series of laws similar to those aimed at reducing the autonomy of Native American tribes, Congress passed a plethora of legislation aimed at the Mormon Church and bringing it to heal and its people to heel. Threats to the continued viability of the church were perceived as so acute that Mormon leaders capitulated. Finally, most Mormons readily embraced the changes that the anti-Mormon legislation was aimed to bring about. Housewives and laborers in Utah had already largely ignored boycotts called by church leaders against Gentile businesses in the 1870s and 80s. And about the same time, leading Mormon citizens were discovering that their own economic and political interests intersected with those of national, political, and economic elites. In 1922, Ephraim Erickson identified this development, where he said, quote, "The most influential men of the Mormon priesthood are businessmen, and as such place high value upon pecuniary ideals and methods," end quote. Erickson pointed out that during the Western colonization period, church revenues were collected and programs administered conscientiously by a small number of church authorities. This priesthood bureaucracy acquired specialized business skills and an administrative outlook. They worked full-time in these positions and began drawing salaries derived from income generated by church investments in a broad range of business corporations. Naturally, Erickson concluded, these church authorities became interested in promoting the businesses from which they received their income. This explains why some of the apostles, this is written in 1922, this explains why some of the apostles became active businessmen and why they adopt the businessman's point of view, end quote. More than 75 years after Erickson's pioneering study, the businessman's point of view is even more thoroughly entrenched among Mormon officialdom. In 1997, almost all of the nearly 100 members of the church administrative hierarchy were successful in business or other professions. By training and association, they are members of an administrative culture. Collectively, they preside over and direct what the Arizona Republic in 1991, and now Time Magazine, has called one of the most growing and powerful economic institutions in the United States, particularly in the West, where much of its wealth is concentrated. We've read estimates. Conservative estimates in 91 of annual church revenues identified $4.5 billion in tithes and offerings, and that's been up by Time to $5.3 billion. And I've heard from a very reliable source that has a very, very conservative estimate of, rather than exaggerated, that it's a very conservative estimate of revenues in tithes and offerings, and also from their investment income. The church also, as you well know, is a major source of income for contractors, craftsmen, and vendors in the Intermountain West, directly employing tens of thousands in its extensive worldwide bureaucracy and in its church and its educational system. The effects and I talk a little bit about welfare and humanitarian programs, which, however nobly intended, were not the same as creating a classless and cooperative society once envisioned by the Mormon community. Once advocates of an economic philosophy, again, which Erickson called radical and socialist, most American Mormons have come to embrace the spirit of free enterprise capitalism and tend to disparage, unlike their fellow saints in Western European nations, the very concept of a welfare state. For the sake of time, I've got to pass over some comments I want to make about these developments, but the net effect of the rise, the integration of Mormon regional economy and the church's economy with the national economy has been the erosion of particular identities, which once Erickson called radical and socialistic, and which now has become, very capitalist and very integrated with the American economy and its politics as well. I'm going to wrap up now. All right. Generally speaking, Mormons have divested themselves of distinctive practices that readily set them apart as American ethnic group. Public Mormon statements and practices with regard to gender roles, sexuality, government, welfare, patriotism, prayer in schools, and secular humanism do not constitute a discourse expressive of an enduring particularistic ethnicity, nor even of inherent distinctions between Mormon theology and social ethics and those of Christian fundamentalism. Rather, they disclose how deeply connected the Mormon church elites and the audience they seek to persuade have become to significant segments of America's evangelical and conservative religious culture. The question that needs to be asked is whose interests are being served by the application of the term ethnicity to the contemporary Mormon community. I want to just sketch two scenarios now that are basically facing the Mormon community in light of rapid international church growth. And Brian, I'll try to make you less uncomfortable by wrapping this up. Talk about rapid church growth. What will the realities behind these numbers mean for Mormon identity as the center of the gravity of the church community relocates south of the Rio Grande? Two dissimilar tracks seem plausible. In the first, while Anglo-American Mormon community, particularly in Utah, continues to diminish in size relative to international church membership, only 16.5% of church membership is in Utah, it will continue, this community, Anglo-American community in Utah, will continue to maintain inordinate control over church administration and policies, privilege its mythic narratives, see the sesquicentennial, and pursue a strategy of convergence with the American religious right. In this scenario, this particular community could argue that it shoulders the greatest share of the church's financial burden, possesses generations of experience in administering church programs, and constitutes an authoritative community of memory within the church by virtue of its direct descent from those whose experiences in the 19th century forged formative American narratives. This group will continue to pursue practical alliances with other conservative American religious groups who learned in the 1980s to claim government protection for their cultural institutions and practices by resorting to the discourse of ethnicity. For the sake of structural, administrative, and ideological stability threatened by secular and multi-ethnic cultures, taking this course suggested above would appear as only prudent in the eyes of Anglo-American Mormon elites. Ironically, however, I believe that it would isolate and reconfigure the Anglo-American community into something like a separate ethnicity within a burgeoning international church. And one last paragraph here. The other alternative, in view of massive international growth, is a prescription for a more cosmopolitan and multi-ethnic religious community, which in the long run corresponds, I believe, more fittingly to Mormonism's profound ideological and institutional commitment to growth by evangelism. Those commitments may, in the end, prove sufficiently compelling to persuade church leaders to substitute Americanized, centralized, these are Larry Young's words, Americanized, centralized, hierarchical, structured administrative style for one more diffuse and amenable to local cultures. It's not yet clear if Mormonism will yet prove to be capable of transcending the particularity of its history and succeeding as an enduring world faith. It seems certain, however, that if it does, Anglo-American Mormons will have learned to value the languages, customs, mythic narratives, rhythms, and arts of their brothers and sisters in the gospel as much, if not more, than their own. And if they do that, Mormon women and men may yet to learn to create that emblematic general symbol predicted in 1862 by Louis Bertrand. Thank you very much.
I'd like to thank Sunstone for inviting me and Steve for sharing this paper with us. I think it's really interesting. Thank you especially for sparing us a discussion of the social science discourse on ethnicity. The concept is a virtual tar pit, a tar pit of mammoth proportions. In fact, swim at your own risk. It's dangerous, but I do want to invite you to test the muddy waters, just briefly. Steve, I believe you're right when you view the concept of ethnicity heuristically, and to question its possible political uses. In the 19th century, while the saints were gathering to Deseret, a handful of European scholars were inventing a new academic discipline. One of their first names for their new subject was ethnology, but eventually the name anthropology won out. For these early ethnologists, ethnicity was a way to talk about human difference, and especially the difference between human groups. This was at a time when our biological and cultural inheritances were regarded as identical. Race and culture were virtual synonyms, and the history of anthropology can be seen as the conceptual unraveling of those two inheritances. Today in anthropology, ethnicity has come to be a way of talking about the culture of a people whose biological distinctiveness may be only imaginary, if imagined at all. But ethnicity is always today regarded as a way of talking about people in their lived relation with others with whom they come in contact and between whom they construct boundaries, boundaries which must be constantly mended. We're mending boundaries right now. Ethnicity is about distinctiveness, both self-constructed and imposed, the two always reciprocally influencing each other. And Steve's analysis, I think, illustrates this very well. The Mormon boundary, perhaps like the boundary of any group that evangelizes vigorously, must be able to do two things. It needs to make coming into the group relatively easy. Newcomers must feel welcome, to feel like they belong. But it needs also to make leaving the community difficult. The boundary needs to be a membrane that favors flow inward, but not outward. During the gathering, Mormons did a remarkable job of creating this boundary, and it would not have been done without the opprobrium of the outside world. While sociologists and social scientists generally today often use ethnicity as a way of understanding how an emerging new group constructs its autonomy, more frequently, social scientists use the concept to understand the persistence of groups, especially the persistence within nation states that try to assimilate or confine, to erase and to scapegoat targeted groups. In this usage, ethnicity becomes synonymous with minority status, and also functions as a kind of foil. But not minority status in the sense of numerical description, but as an index of political power. Assimilation to the national norm and to the dominant cultural norms become a way of shedding minority status in an effort to achieve privilege. Steve's analysis of the 20th century seems to work well here, too. The gathering as a physical, geographical process helped Mormons create a place outside the dominant society, a place which also served as a prophetic moral ground from which to critique the world and on which to create a new one. But early Mormon ethnicity and early Mormon ethnicity was a product of the saints' ability to critique society from this self-created distance. This geographical distance is no longer possible. What social and cultural and moral ground will assimilating Mormonism create as the basis of future spirituality and moral critique? Today we see the hierarchy erasing some boundaries and drawing new ones. Steve describes this as the temptation of fundamentalism, and I too find it disturbing to see the moral ground the brethren seem to be carving out. But we also will need to watch how members and converts are constructing their Mormon identities to get a better picture. During the gathering, Mormonism was importantly a critique of industrial production, of how things are made, the conditions of labor and the distribution of commonly produced wealth. The global economic system has made economic autonomy and self-reliance seemingly impossible. Today, Mormon leaders have no critique of the conditions of labor and no critique of the distribution of wealth. They have shifted their focus from production to consumption. They have concern now is with what is consumed, not how things are produced. Self-reliance is replaced with self-denial and self-control. The one exception to this critique of economic activity are the efforts to keep women at home, which is not a critique of production, but of who should participate in it. Also, during the gathering, Mormons experimented with ways to extend family and family-like relationships. Polygamy, adoption, and other forms of sealing expanded family by increasing the number of individuals with which one had familial relationships and the forms of cooperation and affection they entail. Today, leaders redraw affectional boundaries and proscribe ever more narrowing concepts of family, love, affection, sexuality, and marriage. What world are current converts removing themselves from as they move into Mormon life today? I should say, what worlds, plural, are converts removing themselves from? For in the increasingly global church, with its ever larger proportion of newly converted members, what converts leave behind and the new ground they find and help create inside Mormonism are going to be increasingly multiple and new. Questions of Mormon ethnicity may now seem moot, but questions of Mormon boundaries, and especially of the grounds for moral critique, are paramount. Where does this leave ethnicity? Perhaps as a metaphor, it strikes me as interesting that saints in Russia would construct handcarts and reenact a trek. And it's very interesting that without using the language of ethnicity, the first 100 years of Mormon history become a metaphor for Mormonism. But it is a trek that is almost reconstructed and reinscribed on the heart and not on geography. And to understand where Mormonism is, and especially where it's going, we will need to do that, to understand that and to see what kind of Mormonism people are creating, not just the Mormonism that leaders construct, but the Mormonism that members also create. My first experience with the concept of Mormon ethnicity was in graduate school in anthropology in New England, where a visiting linguist was there to give a colloquium, and I was introduced to him as a Mormon from Utah by one of the professors, and the linguist said, "Oh, that's very interesting. The Mormons are the only American ethnic group that was formed on this land." And I had not known that before or even thought about it that way. It gave currency within the department. But it became daunting when I was invited to, or when we had our graduate school potluck dinners and was asked to bring something ethnically Mormon. The only thing I could think of seriously was potato salad, which brought blank faces to everyone I suggested it to. And at that time, I was unaware of the Jell-O matrix, so that was out. But one thing that I did learn about ethnicity was leaving New England and going to the South, where I have lived for the last over 20 years, and discovering that, in fact, white Southerners, without using the language, regard themselves as an ethnic group in relationship to American society, and that the meaning of things is really where ethnicity and boundary maintenance lies. Because my first experiences with hearing Southerners talk about what is Southern were descriptions of things that rang perfectly true to my experience growing up in Utah as a Mormon. And yet they saw what they were doing as, quintessentially Southern. And when they had family reunions, they were not just visiting their family, they were also reconstructing a Southern identity. And to an outsider, they may look like they're doing the same thing you're doing in Utah. And I think this is really essential to an understanding of what the concept of ethnicity is really about. It's not an objective term. It is, its objectivity lies in its subjectivity. It is about meaning, about self-definition, and about perceiving oneself as different from others, whether that difference looks different to a third, you know, outsider or not. Thank you, Steve.
I'd like to thank our panel speakers.